This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This week marks the 35th anniversary of a tragedy at sea at Yankee Station in the Gulf of Tonkin. On July 29, 1967, 134 American sailors gave their lives aboard the aircraft carrier USS Forrestal. They were honored this past Monday at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C.
Richard A. Hatcher, William K. Hinckley, Jr., Stephen L. Hawk.
These men died in battle, but a battle of a different kind. The sailors lost aboard the Forrestal died in a fire. Their story is told in a new book by author Gregory Freeman. The book is called Sailors to the End: The Deadly Fire on the USS Forrestal and the Heroes Who Fought It. Gregory Freeman joins us in our studios. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined here by retired Rear Admiral John Beeling, who commanded the Forrestal through the fire. Admiral, thank you for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks.
Let me ask you, gentlemen, to cast back to 35 years ago. Early summer of 1967, the Forrestal left its home port of Norfolk, Virginia on May 18th. The war in Vietnam was at a certain stage of its development. And in your book, Mr. Freeman, you suggest that the haste to mount a massive bombing campaign was a prescription for disaster, if I might put it that simply.
I think in a lot of ways what you saw happening on the Forrestal when it was in Tonkin Gulf was a microcosm of what was happening with the Vietnam War in general. You had people like Captain Beeling and others who were sending reports back to Washington and the Pentagon about the realities of what was going on out in the field. But unfortunately, some of the orders coming back from the White House and the Pentagon did not take those realities into account.
Maybe we should explain. U.S. military was interested in a massive bombing campaign that they thought could end the war.
Right.
Must say, almost before a lot of Americans were aware that it had begun in any size in 1967. And therefore, there was a massive amount of ordnance that was delivered to the Forrestal. And Captain Beeling, maybe you can take over here. It was old ordnance, wasn't it?
Well, not all of it. Now, we had not been out there very long before this thing happened.
Yeah.
But we had launched a number of good-sized strikes. They called them alpha strikes. Well, they would involve from 20 to 40 planes. And when we needed more bombs, we would put in a requisition for what we needed. We ordered 1,000-pound bombs, expecting and actually specifying the newer variety of them. I assumed that we would get what we ordered, because that is all. Navy has always run that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess they just didn't have them. So we had to find out the hard way.
Greg Freeman, what was the drawback in some of this older ordnance?
Like the captain said, it wasn't all of the ordnance delivered the night before the fire, but some of the 1,000-pound bombs were manufactured as early as 1935, according to some of the information.
And, it's even stamped on some of the crates.
Right. And, you know, even in 1967, modern weaponry was designed to withstand some time in a fire without blowing up right away.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being that you can get in there, put out the fire before you have these huge bombs going off. But these bombs, unfortunately, were so old and unstable that once the fire started, the first one exploded after only a minute and a half in the fire. And that completely changed the face of everything. It turned what could have been a small problem into a catastrophe.
I've got to ask you, gentlemen, to pick up the narrative just before 11 a.m. on July 29. The ship, Admiral, I guess, was beginning to launch a strike,
Let me start the day before.
Yeah.
We lost a man overboard at night. So what you have to do is you've got to go back and look for this fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hilo was able to find him.
Helicopter.
Yep. They let down a sling for him, but he was exhausted and he fell out of the sling. Well, a lot of us were up all the rest of the night trying to get him. And unfortunately, we never did find him.
Yeah.
So the next morning started with an early strike taking off from the ship, I don't remember the exact time, but around 6 a.m., 37 aircraft that went and struck North Vietnam facilities.
Gregory Freeman, if I could get you to pick up the narrative. Massive strike is planned for that morning.
Right. And at 10:52, a Zuni rocket accidentally fired from one of the planes. It was through a series of electrical glitches and a couple of safety shortcuts that probably shouldn't have been taken. But the rocket accidentally fired across the deck and went straight into the plane occupied by John McCain.
And that man.
I mean, Senator John McCain. Right. Yeah.
Well, let me interrupt just a little bit. It actually didn't hit the airplane. The airplane was carrying underneath it a 400-gallon auxiliary tank, which would be dropped when empty. And that rocket went right through that tank, and it started an immediate conflagration because of the enormous heat of the rocket fuel. So there was 400 gallons spilling on the deck, burning, and there was a wind of over 40 miles an hour fanning that fire. So what could be done about it? Stop the ship, because the ship was making most of the wind.
And you just don't stop a ship like that by...
Well, I'll tell you, you can stop them goddamn quickly. And we did.
Yeah.
You began to feel like God was pulling the ship back.
Yeah.
She shook and shivered and slowed down really very dramatically. So after a while, I started her up again with mild speed just to have enough draft over the fire to keep it from moving forward in the ship.
Of all the names that we could mention, both of the 134 people who died and it must be said the thousands who lived and survived and fought the fire to defeat, there is one name I want to make particular note of right now. James Blaskus.
James Blaskus was one of the three men trapped in port after steering. And the bombs had ripped through this area so badly that it was impossible for them to get out, and it was impossible for anyone to get in to help them. But they were able to call in to Merv Roland, chief engineering officer. He was in damage control, and to report their situation. And Merv had to eventually, after many efforts had been made, he had to eventually tell them that nobody could get to them, and they were going to be on their own for a long while. He stayed on the phone with James Blaskus and listened as they made the necessary changes that were so important for the ship, and then listened as each one of the three men, one by one, died. And the phone fell silent, and he knew that Blaskus was dead.
Admiral, I hope you don't mind if I ask this. To lose 134 of your men must have been like losing, in some ways, 134 of your sons.
Well, there certainly is that aspect to it, and it's a good way to look at it. On the other hand, wars cause casualties. We had 6,000 people on the ship, and we lost 134. So if we had been a division in battle, that 134 loss would not have stopped us from the next day's operations. And in fact, we did carry out some operations the next day, but they weren't bombing operations.
Admiral, you addressed the crew when you finally had a chance. Could I get you to read the words that you said to your crew that day?
It starts out, as all those messages did, "Men of Forrestal, this is the captain. Now let us pray. Our Heavenly Father, we see this day as 1 minute, yet as a lifetime for each one of us. We thank you for the courage of those who gave their lives, saving their shipmates today. We humbly ask you to grant them peace and to their dependents and loved ones the consolation and strength to bear their loss. We thank you for our own lives, realizing acutely that we have them only because you were with each of us every instant of that day.
And I want to note, there was an investigation, you were exonerated, you were promoted to Rear Admiral, and then you got posted to Iceland, which wouldn't seem to be the place to be.
Well, let me comment on that.
Yeah.
Iceland is a very fine place. The average temperature in Reykjavik, the city, is slightly warmer than in New York over a year.
I didn't know that. I'll remember that, though. So I'm wrong to feel that you were in any way undercut.
Well, a very senior officer, the commander-in-chief of the Atlantic Fleet, reprimanded me. It was only one sentence long. Mm-hmm. You're reprimanded for your actions in the Tonkin Gulf or something to that effect. When one gets a letter like that, you have a choice. You can either accept the reprimand or you can request a court-martial.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought very seriously I would request a court-martial. But I turned that down because I could see that it would have been washing the Navy's dirty linen out in front of the entire United States at a poor time to do it. So I accepted the reprimand.
Greg, if we could turn to you. Was this fire an embarrassment to the Navy?
I think in 1967 it was, and I would like to point out also Captain's reprimand was rescinded soon mm-hmm. after. He was not left with that reprimand. I think the reason that the true story about the cause of the 134 deaths, the old bombs and such, the reason that story didn't really come out for 35 years is that the Navy probably was embarrassed about mm-hmm. the whole situation. And this, you have to remember, this was 1967, and you had growing anti-war protests. You had an ongoing conflict in Vietnam. And it just wouldn't do for the Navy to come out in public and say, you know, we didn't have the weaponry to do what we kept saying we were going to do in Vietnam. And you couldn't say we shipped faulty weaponry to our men and caused the deaths. And I think that was perpetuated for 35 years to the extent that the Forrestal crew has been sort of labeled unjustly as responsible for the tragedy that day. And it's just now that a lot of them are really finding out the true story of what happened, and that not only were they now responsible for the deaths, but that they really should be commended for what they were able to do that day in saving the 5,000 men.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Yes, Admiral.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thank you.
Retired Rear Admiral John Beeling was captain of the USS Forrestal and its crews in Vietnam in 1967. Author Gregory Freeman's new book is Sailors to the End, The Deadly Fire on the USS Forrestal and the Heroes Who Fought It, published by William Morrow. For more on the Forrestal tragedy, you can consult our website, npr.org. Let's now hear more of the 134 names of sailors who gave their lives on July 29, 1967. The names were read at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial this past Monday by a veteran of the Forrestal, Lou Brosh, and the bell was sounded by his shipmate, Milt Crutchley.
Gregory L. Webb, Gerald A. Weddy, Judson A. Wells, Jr., Richard J. Westcott, Edward J. Wessels, Fred D. White, Curry D. Wisdom,